Chapter 11. And Fog, with a face unmoved and averted eyes, grasped all his mighty beard in one vast palm. Was it right then for me to die myself? He asked thoughtfully. I laid my hand on his shoulder. Go away, I whispered imperiously, without any clear reason for this advice, except that I wished to put an end to Herman's odious noise. Go away. He looked searchingly for a moment at Herman, before he made a move. I left the cabin to see him out of the ship. But he hung about the quarter deck. It is my misfortune, he said in a steady voice. You were stupid to blurt it out in such a manner. After all, we don't hear such confidences every day. What does the man mean? He mused in deep undertones. Homebody had to die, but why me? He remained still for a time in the dark, silent, almost invisible. All at once he pinned my elbows to my sides. I felt utterly powerless in his grip, and his voice, whispering in my ear, vibrated. It's worse than hunger. Captain, do you know what that means? And I could kill then or be killed. I wish the crowbar had smashed my skull 10 years ago. And I've got to live now. Without her. Do you understand? Perhaps many years. But how? What can be done? If I had allowed myself to look at her once, I would have carried her off before that man in my hands like this. I felt myself snatched off the deck, then suddenly dropped, and I staggered backwards, feeling bewildered and bruised. What a man! All was still, he was gone. I heard Herman's voice declaiming in the cabin, and I went in. I could not at first make out a single word, but Mrs. Herman, who, attracted by the noise, had come in some time before, with an expression of surprise and mild disapproval, depicted broadly on her face, was giving now all the signs of profound, helpless agitation. Her husband shot a string of guttural words at her, and instantly putting out one hand to the bulkhead, as if to save herself from falling, she clutched the loose bosom of her dress with the other. He harangued the two women extraordinarily, with much of his shirt hanging out of his waistbelt, stamping his foot, turning from one to the other, sometimes throwing both his arms to Jeter, straight up above his rumpled hair, and keeping them in that position, while he uttered a passage of loud denunciation, at others folding them tight across his breast, and then he hissed with indignation, elevating his shoulders and protruding his head. The girl was crying. As he had not changed her attitude. From her steady eyes that, following Falk in his retreat, had remained fixed wistfully on the cabin door, the tears fell rapid, thick, on her hands, on the work in her lap, warm and gentle like a shower in spring. She wept without grimacing, without noise, very touching, very quiet, with something more of pity than of pain in her face, as one weeps in compassion, rather than in grief, and Herman, before her, declaimed. I caught several times the word mensch, man, and also resin, which last I looked up afterwards in my dictionary. It means devour. Herman seemed to be requesting an answer of some sort from her. His whole body swayed. She remained mute and perfectly still. At last his agitation gained her. She put the palms of her hands together, her full lips parted, no sound came. His voice scolded shrilly, his arms went like a windmill. Suddenly he shook a thick fist at her. She burst out into loud sobs. He seemed stupefied. Mrs. Herman rushed forward babbling raptly. The two women fell on each other's necks, and, with an arm round her niece's waist, she led her away. Her own eyes were simply streaming, her face was flooded. She shook her head back at me negatively, I wonder why to this day. The girl's head dropped heavily on her shoulder. They disappeared. Then Herman sat down and stared at the cabin floor. We don't know all the circumstances, I ventured to break the silence. He retorted tartly that he didn't want to know of any. According to his ideas, no circumstances could excuse a crime, and certainly not such a crime. This was the opinion generally received. The duty of a human being was to starve. Falk therefore was a beast, an animal, base, low, vile, despicable, shameless, and deceitful. He had been deceiving him since last year. He was, however, inclined to think that Falk must have gone mad quite recently. For no sane person, without necessity, uselessly, for no earthly reason, and regardless of another's self-respect and peace of mind, would own to having devoured human flesh. "I tell?" he cried. Ho was asking him. It showed Falk's brutality, because after all he had selfishly caused him, Herman, much pain. He would have preferred not to know that such an unclean creature had been in the habit of caressing his children. He hoped I would say nothing of all this ashore, though. He wouldn't like it to get about that he had been intimate with an eater of many common cannibal. As to the scene he had made, which I judged quite unnecessary, he was not going to inconvenience, and restrain himself for a fellow that went about courting and upsetting girls' heads, while he knew all the time that no decent housewifely girl could think of marrying him. At least he, Herman, could not conceive how any girl could. Fancy Lena, no, it was impossible. The thoughts that would come into their heads every time they sat down to a meal. Horrible. Horrible. You are too squeamish, Herman, I said. He seemed to think it was eminently proper to be squeamish, if the word meant disgust at Falk's conduct. And turning up his eyes sentimentally, he drew my attention to the horrible fate of the victims of that Falk. I said that I knew nothing about them. He seemed surprised. Could not anybody imagine without knowing? He, for instance, felt he would like to avenge them. But what if, said I, there had not been any? They might have died, as it were, naturally of starvation. He shuddered. But to be eaten after death? To be devoured? He gave another deep shudder, and asked suddenly, do you think it is true? His indignation and his personality together would have been enough to spoil the reality of the most authentic thing. When I looked at him, I doubted the story, but the remembrance of Falk's words, looks, gestures, invested it not only with an air of reality, but with the absolute truth of primitive passion. It is true just as much as you are able to make it. And exactly in the way you like to make it. For my part, when I hear you clamoring about it, I don't believe it is true at all. And I left him pondering. The men in my boat lying at the foot of Diana's side ladder told me that the captain of the tug had gone away in his gig some time ago. I let my fellows pull an easy stroke. Because of the heavy dew, the clear sparkle of the stars seemed to fall on me cold and wetting. There was a sense of lurking gruesome horror somewhere in my mind, and it was mingled with clear and grotesque images. Schomburg's gastronomic tittle-tattle was responsible for these, and I half hoped I should never see Falk again. But the first thing my anchor watchman told me was that the captain of the tug was on board. He had sent his boat away, and was now waiting for me in the cuddy. He was lying full length on the stern settee, his face buried in the cushions. I had expected to see it discomposed, contorted, despairing. It was nothing of the kind. It was just as I had seen it 20 times, steady and glaring from the bridge of the tug. It was immovably set and hungry, dominated like the whole man by the singleness of one instinct. He wanted to live. He had always wanted to live. So we all do, but in us the instinct serves a complex conception, and in him this instinct existed alone. There is in such simple development a gigantic force, and like the pathos of a child's naive and uncontrolled desire. He wanted that girl, and the utmost that can be said for him was that he wanted that particular girl alone. I think I saw then the obscure beginning, the seed germinating in the soil of an unconscious need, the first shoot of that tree bearing now for a mature mankind the flower and the fruit, the infinite gradation in shades and in flavor of our discriminating love. He was a child. He was as frank as a child too. He was hungry for the girl, terribly hungry, as he had been terribly hungry for food. Don't be shocked if I declare that in my belief it was the same need, the same pain, the same torture. We are in this case allowed to contemplate the foundation of all the emotions, that one joy which is to live, and the one sadness at the root of the innumerable torments. It was made plain by the way he talked. He had never suffered so. It was gnawing, it was fire, it was there, like this. And after pointing below his breastbone, he made a hard ringing motion with his hands. And I assure you that, seen as I saw it with my bodily eyes, it was anything but laughable. And again, as he was presently to tell me, alluding to an early incident of the disastrous voyage, when some damaged meat had been flung overboard, he said that a time soon came when his heart ached, that was the expression he used, and he was ready to tear his hair out at the thought of all that rotten beef thrown away. I had heard all this. I witnessed his physical struggles, seeing the working of the rack, and hearing the true voice of pain. I witnessed it all potentially, because the moment I came into the cuddy he had called upon me to stand by him, and this, it seems, I had diplomatically promised. His agitation was impressive and alarming in the little cabin, like the floundering of a great whale driven into a shallow cove in a coast. He stood up. He flung himself down headlong. He tried to tear the cushion with his teeth. And again hugging it fiercely to his face, he let himself fall on the couch. The whole ship seemed to feel the shock of his despair, and I contemplated with wonder the lofty forehead, the noble touch of time on the uncovered temples, the unchanged hungry character of the face so strangely ascetic, and so incapable of portraying emotion. What should he do? He had lived by being near her. He had sat in the evening I knew, all his life. She sewed. Her head was bent so. Her head like this and her arms. Ah! Had I seen? Like this. He dropped on a stool, bowed his powerful neck whose nape was red, and with his hand stitched the air, ludicrous, sublimely imbecile and comprehensible. And now he couldn't have her? No. That was too much. After thinking to that. What had he done? What was my advice? Take her by force? No? Mustn't he? Who was there then to kill him? For the first time I saw one of his features move, a fighting teeth-bearing curl of the lip. A Terman, perhaps. He lost himself in thought, as though he had fallen out of the world. I may note that the idea of suicide apparently did not enter his head for a single moment. It occurred to me to ask. Where was it that this shipwreck of yours took place? Down south, he said vaguely with a start. You are not down south now, I said. Io Lens won't do. They would take her away from you in no time. And what was the name of the ship? Borgmester Dahl, he said. T was no shipwreck. He seemed to be waking up by degrees from that trance, and waking up calmed. Not a shipwreck? What was it? Breakdown, he answered, looking more like himself every moment. By this only I learned that it was a steamer. I had till then supposed they had been starving in boats, or on a raft, or perhaps on a barren rock. She did not sink then? I asked in surprise. He nodded. He cited the southern ice, he... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.